to teach people. I want to thank you so much for being with us and for all that you've offered, not just the labor movement, but to your humanity, your in organizing, your brilliance and strategizing. Thank you so much. We're going to do part two in a minute. Jane McAlevey, labor organizer for 20 years. That does it for our show. To see that interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different.
Well, I'm glad you stopped me. Yes, if we have kept you from doing something stupid, by all means, thank us by pledging to WUSB. WUSB.fm is our website, and you can find all the pledge material and ways of supporting this radio station on that site. It's one of the few community radio stations left. WUSB Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM, as well as over the internet at WUSB.fm. The time is 6 o'clock. Time once again for another edition of Off the Wall. And this is one of those shows where you let the whole theme play. Actually, you know what? I'm talking over it. Then I have to do it again. Oh, well. Yes, it's Off the Wall back after several weeks. We were preempted 1 week. We were away for 2 weeks chasing eclipses and driving across the country like lunatics. It's Manuel. Kyle's over there. And, it's good to be back. Good to be back in the... in the studio, as it is, and boy, what a wacky place this country is. We stopped in Washington, D.C. on the way back, which I think was a good idea, because we got to kind of wander around the entire town, sort of relax a little bit, which is something to do in D.C. But here's the cool thing. You're able to sit in on the House of Representatives, you're able to sit in on the Senate, but in order to do that, you have to visit your representative or your senator, actually both, depending on which body you wish to sit in on. We went on a tour of the Capitol building, and that's where we found out how to get into the rest of, you know, where things were actually happening. And it's just, it's so open and inviting. I mean, it's weird for me to say that. And it's not really that open and inviting, because you have to go through security. And since we were going in and out of various buildings that entire day, I think we went through at least 6 security screenings, which was pretty crazy. And the interesting thing is, when you get to the security screening right before you enter the chamber, the gallery, whatever they call it, where, you know, C-SPANville, where you look down and you see what people are doing or not doing. I'll get to that in a second. There's another security check. You've already been through a security check, but they have a second one. I don't know what you're going to pick up along the way, but there's this other security screening, and it seems to be a bit more, I don't know, rigorous or just different in various ways. I don't want to say they're nastier, but they're not as nice. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I had the same things in my pocket, you know, keys and, apparently a flash drive is not considered appropriate to bring onto the House floor or gallery. But it was different. You know, instead of going through a metal detector, now you're going through that thing where you have to wave your arms and, you know, get imaged and all that. And then they tell you to take everything out of your pocket for that. And then once you're out, you have to put everything back in your pocket. And of course, you're in a hurry at that point, just like at the airport. In this particular case, though, I think this was for the house. They were asking if something was mine, and it wasn't mine. It was Kyle's. You know, it was next to mine. And this woman asked me the same thing three times. Is this yours? And I said, no, it's still not mine. No, it's not mine. I wasn't being obnoxious. I just said, it's not mine. And then she says, take it. You know? And I'm like, what? Take it? And she's standing between me and everything on the table. So what, is this a challenge? What's going on here? How can I take it? First of all, I can't reach it. Second of all, it's not mine. So that was the kind of interaction I had to deal with right before witnessing Congress in action. And, okay, getting to Congress in action, boy, this is what they don't show you on C-SPAN, because C-SPAN doesn't really have control of the cameras. They basically they run the things. They keep it going. They broadcast it. But it's the House themselves that controls the cameras. That's why when the House lost control a little while back, and C-SPAN was able to broadcast whatever they wanted, we saw a lot more than what we usually see. And in this particular case, what was going on when we were there, it was basically just two congressmen going back and forth, you know, reading things and having motions and yielding time and all that. There was almost nobody there. It was those two, their assistants, a couple other people, you know, the person with the gavel, and that's it. And that's how it is a lot of the time. Most of the time, I would say. There are very, very few people there. You don't see that when you look at it on TV. You just see the front. You know, it's very Politburo type style, where you believe there's something going on, and there really isn't. Or what's going on is completely mundane and boring. So that was the case both in the House, and we went to the Senate, viewing the Senate. Now, that was interesting because they were taking some kind of a vote in the Senate, and I don't know what they were voting on exactly. It was some kind of procedural thing, I think, but there was definitely a yes and a no vote going on. And the way they vote, and I didn't realize this at the time. Kyle told me later on this is normal. They do thumbs up, thumbs down. Do you remember when John McCain saved Obamacare with the thumbs down? I thought he was being dramatic, but no, that's how they actually do it. That is how they actually vote. Thumbs up, thumbs down. And it's pretty ridiculous because senators just walk through a door, do the thumbs up or thumbs down, and then walk out. You don't see that on C-SPAN because you're only looking at the front. There was one jackass there who was dressed in blue jeans. One of the Republicans who thinks it's a big form of rebellion to not adhere to the dress code. And he was basically leaning in because he wasn't allowed on the Senate floor in blue jeans. I don't know if he voted thumbs up or thumbs down, but that is basically the shenanigans that go on there that you don't see. So it was fun, though. It was fun sitting there for about a half hour watching various senators go by. We saw Bernie Sanders come in and wander around. We saw Mitch McConnell kind of get, well, I don't want to say wheeled in, but he just sort of moved in and stopped and stayed in the same position for about 20 minutes. But he was talking. He was talking to Chuck Schumer, and I understand they were trying to work out some kind of a deal. Yeah, that's your government in action. That's what it's all about. So I'm glad we stopped. Glad we stopped in D.C. and kind of wandered around and did a lot of walking because it's a great city to walk in. So I do recommend it. It's not not hard to do. You have to go to various Senate office buildings and House office buildings. Visit your representative. I couldn't bring myself to visit Lalota, who's my representative. I couldn't do it. I had to go to Swazi. I had to go to the guy that just got put back in office because it would have been too embarrassing. It would have been so. Yeah, I had to lie. I had to lie in the House congressional office and say that Swazi was my representative, not Lalota. Didn't matter. Wherever you knock on the door, say you're a constituent, they will give you a pass, and you take that little pass and you show it to somebody in the Capitol and go through a couple of security screenings, and you'll be witnessing Congress and seeing the things that you don't see on C-SPAN. Okay, so where are we today? We've got the Trump hush money trial That's going on. What day is it? Today is Tuesday. They did all of last week, right? But this is actually the second day of the trial. So, yeah, that's I guess day two of the trial. They've selected the jury last week, and now they're full speed ahead, or some speed ahead. I guess they're calling it day six. I guess it's day six. I don't know. So it's day six. Okay. It featured testimony from David Pecker, veteran tabloid editor, who talked about the catch-and-kill arrangement he struck with Trump and his then-attorney Michael Cohen during the presidential election of 2016. Former president on trial in New York. I can't believe it's actually happening. Felony charges of falsifying business records to hide the reimbursement of a hush money payment Cohen made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels in order to boost his electoral prospects in the 2016 presidential election. He let jurors in on the secret catch and kill arrangement, which was at the heart of the prosecutor's case, describing the very first story he caught and killed pursuant to his agreement with Trump and Cohen, which was a false story from a Trump Tower doorman in 2015. That said Trump had fathered an illegitimate girl with a maid at Trump Tower. Pecker testified he immediately called Michael Cohen when his team got wind of those allegations being shopped by the doorman. Cohen told him it was absolutely not true, but Pecker testified that he ultimately moved forward with buying the exclusive rights to the story for $30,000 so he could lock it up. Yeah. Well, anyway, before trial proceedings got underway today, Judge Juan Merchan convened a hearing to address whether Trump had violated the judge's limited gag order by targeting prospective witnesses, including Cohen and Daniels. Judge Merchan expressed skepticism when Trump attorney Todd Blanche defended Trump's social media posts by saying Trump was only responding to attacks. "You have presented nothing," Merchan said. "I've asked 8 or 9 times. Show me the exact post he was responding to." And they've got nothing. You know, the way to look at this, in my view, is how you handle yourself in court kind of speaks to how you handle yourself in a position of responsibility. You know, being a defendant, it's tough. I was a defendant in that very court, and it's not easy. Not the same thing, but boy, it's, you know, a lot of pressure, and you want to look your best, obviously. So if somebody can't handle themselves in a courtroom, if they misbehave constantly, if they have to be chastised by the judge, if they have to be told over and over again to behave, if jurors are fearing for their safety because of your actions, if witnesses are afraid to testify because of what you might say or do, doesn't that speak to how you would hold an important office like President of the United States? I mean, you know, regardless of who you prefer, it has to say something. You have to look at this and say, "Whoa, this person just doesn't really have what it takes, or could be a danger in a stressful situation." I mean, you know, what is a stressful situation? Being on trial is stressful. And being president of the United States, also stressful. So, yeah, let's look at this, you know, as kind of a barometer of what we're dealing with here. Now, in traveling across the country, we had all kinds of interactions with people. Some of them, actually pretty much all of them were good. We didn't have political debates. We didn't have, you know, long discussions about society or anything like that. Basically, simple things. Basic things. Things that we can agree on. So, when you establish that, when you establish that kind of, I guess, you know, we're all on the same side in one form or another, then you can move on. And assuming, you know, we stuck around for longer, we probably would have moved on and had more serious, important conversations. But that is something that I'd learn every time I travel across the country. It's not the way it's portrayed. It's not the way it's portrayed in the media. You know, you listen to the AM radio, you listen to the religious radio, and it makes it sound like there are battles going on in the street. It makes it sound like you fear for your life in one place or another, depending on who you are or what you look like. It's not the case. Oh, yeah, there are problems. There are big problems, and we're definitely not shying away from those. But we can establish a base, at least, and, you know, have some kind of common ground. I don't think we realize that enough, and I don't think we're told that enough, because it's not in the interest of the people that peddle the hate for us to get along. Imagine if we got along. Imagine if one side listened to the other side and maybe took that side occasionally. You know, the way things were at one point, it was never perfect, it was never really great, but there was dialogue. Okay, what else? This is a great headline that I actually just saw right before the show. Tesla learns hard lesson. Go anti-woke, go broke. Yeah. About time we start hearing this. You know, why does the conservative base always get the catchy phrases? No, it's time for the woke base to get something like that. Yeah, things are not going well at Tesla right now. The stock's down more than $100 per share. As many as 20,000 people are set to lose their jobs. The Cybertruck keeps breaking. I saw one of those. Actually, I saw three of those, all in Florida. It looks like something out of a cartoon. You ever see one of these Cybertrucks? It looks like something a kid built. Something to watch. I don't know if I'd feel safe inside one, but I haven't seen any around here, but they're out there, Cybertrucks. Anyway, the operating profit is expected to be down 40% when it's announced later, and the $25,000 electric vehicle that Tesla has reportedly been working on is apparently canceled. As the Wall Street Journal reports, some but not all of that stress can be attributed to Tesla alienating what was previously its most valuable demographic. Wait for it. Democrats. Yeah, historically, Democrats have bought Teslas in significantly larger numbers than people with other political affiliations. And as Elon Musk has moved to the right, interacting with far-right accounts, promoting race science, anti-Semitism, homophobia, transphobia, and complaining about the woke mind virus, the number of Democrats interested in giving him their money has dropped significantly. And late last year, that figure dropped by more than 60%. So, yeah. Go anti-woke, go broke. And while Republicans have embraced Musk's political heel turn, they haven't necessarily been buying his cars in large enough numbers to offset the sharp drop in interest from left-leaning people. And that's likely due in part to Republican politicians using electric vehicles as an example of how Democrats want to destroy the auto industry and control your life and force you to own nothing and eat bugs. This is from a site called Jalopnik.com. And while surveys have found lower consumer interest in Teslas ever since Musk bought Twitter, when it came to actual sales, Democrats didn't really start to drop off significantly until last October. They made up 40% of Tesla's sales for the 2022 model year, 39% for 2023, 2024, about 15%. Yeah. So, hard lesson there. Hard lesson to learn. Sorry, I have to take a sip of coffee on the air because otherwise it's going to get cold. And okay, Kyle's not in the studio, so I don't have anybody to fill those spaces. So it's either cold coffee or uncomfortable pauses. Take your choice. So, okay, we've probably, you might have heard some of it on Democracy Now! You've probably heard some of it in the news. You might be aware of it just by talking to people, but there is a movement going on various college campuses in this country. Going to dive into a little bit of what NPR has been reporting about pro-Palestinian encampments and protests spreading on college campuses across the U.S. Tensions are growing on U.S. college campuses as the pro-Palestinian demonstrations that have rocked New York area schools in recent days and the ensuing arrest of participants spread from coast to coast. Students have launched protests and encampments at more than a dozen schools around the country, from Massachusetts to Michigan to California. They're calling for an end both to the Israel-Hamas war and the university's investment in companies that profit from it, or more broadly, do business with Israel. And I think it's great. I think it's amazing that college students are taking an interest in what's going on in the world and expressing their beliefs, their passion, their demands. That is what college is all about. Hey, it ended the Vietnam War, didn't it? And, you know, you can accuse college students of being somewhat naive, inexperienced, you know, not having all the facts. Sure, that's part of it. That's where the learning comes in. So, you know, having this exuberance, this enthusiasm, this eagerness to learn and to basically change the world was met universally with positivity and support by college administration. No, I'm kidding. People are being arrested all over the place, being accused of all kinds of nonsense. You know, it all started. Well, it didn't all start at Stony Brook, but it did start at Stony Brook because we had 9 demonstrators arrested during a pro-Palestinian protest last month. So, yeah, Stony Brook was one of the schools. In case those of you going here might not know this, or maybe even living here or listening to this radio station might not know, that Stony Brook was known as the Berkeley of the East in the 1960s and 70s. What that meant, well, it meant 2 things. What the administration wanted it to mean was that it would carry the academic excellence of the University of California at Berkeley, which it did, still does, maybe even better now. But what it turned into was the college campus becoming as fraught with activism and protests and demonstrations and shutdowns in regards to Richard Nixon and the Vietnam War and all that fun stuff from the 1960s and 70s. That's what it turned into. So, you know, we still have that spark. Might not be as big a spark, but it can turn into a big spark with the right ingredients. And so there are people who are speaking out on pretty much all kinds of issues. Here's a little bit from the Statesman, our newspaper on campus. What started as a relatively standard protest on Stony Brook University's campus on Tuesday, March 26, ended with 9 individuals arrested after a sit-in demonstration at the university's administration building. Pro-Palestinian protests have been a common occurrence on campus since the Israel-Hamas war broke out last October, but this is the first instance of demonstrators being arrested by law enforcement, namely the university police department. Like many of the past protests, demonstrators organized by the Stony Brook chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, gathered in front of the administration building at 1 p.m. They aimed to protest the ongoing loss of life in Gaza at the hands of the Israeli government, as well as advocate for Stony Brook to completely divest from Israel. according to Gaza health officials, which people say, hey, they're affiliated with Hamas. Well, yeah, you know what? There's nobody else. So either you say it's all peachy over there and nothing's really going on, or you listen to the only figures that you get. And these are people working in hospitals and doctors and aid workers of all sorts who only exist there because they're Palestinian or they get approval from the people who run the place, which, unfortunately, is Hamas. Anyway, according to Gaza health officials, over 32,000 Palestinians have been killed. This is March, so that number is way outdated now. And those attacks by the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, following October 7th, there's also mounting concern over a possible humanitarian crisis that could come from the IDF's planned invasion of Rafah, a city in the southern part of Gaza where many refugees from the war are sheltering. Okay, so basically, same situation, where you have people expressing themselves on a college campus and paying for it with their freedom, being arrested for having a sit-in, protesting. And this is not uncommon. It happens. But the way that administrations respond is also very telling. It says something about what's important to them, what they believe is significant and what is not. Now, going back to present day, where we're seeing this spreading throughout the country, basically, Columbia University, NYU, we're seeing encampments, and we're seeing crackdowns. We're seeing a whole bunch of arrests. Monday morning, police arrested nearly 50 protesters at Yale University, while Columbia University, which has seen rising tensions since over 100 demonstrators were arrested last week, shifted all their classes online. And they're going to do this till the end of the semester. Yeah, the end of the semester, which apparently is next Monday, which, wow, okay, April? Semester's end in April now? I didn't know that. So that's their way of dealing with it, basically closing down the campus. Now, that's one way of handling it. Another way of handling it would be to, hey, you know, we're a college campus. Why don't we have teach-ins? Why don't we have, you know, basically a way for people to learn more about the situation? Rather than what we're seeing both in the media and in the PR of these universities, where basically they're accusing the demonstrators of being a bunch of anti-Semitic thugs, where the term pro-Palestinian is equivalent to terrorist. I mean, turn on the news, and that is what you are seeing. Students at Northwestern University, Ohio State University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Temple University, Princeton University, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and others have all held walkouts and rallies in support of Columbia students last week after their... Wait, why didn't they do that for Stony Brook? Our students got arrested first. Typical. A pro-Palestinian student group at the University of Minnesota tweeted that they were joining with Columbia students by setting up an encampment on their own campus lawn at 4 a.m. on Tuesday. I mean, come on. To get college students to get together and do something at 4 a.m. on a Tuesday, you got to give them credit for that. And that would be in solidarity with the people of Palestine and with students standing up for Palestine across the country. Anything I've said so far, is that a problem? Is that something objectionable? People standing up for the people of Palestine? People standing up against death and destruction and war and all that? I haven't heard a single word, a single phrase that should be objectionable to anybody with a conscience, to anybody who is slightly human. Because, you know, when you see scenes of people suffering Your only response should be, how can I help to stop this? And unfortunately, that's apparently not what they're supposed to be doing. Students at the University of Pittsburgh also set up tents Tuesday morning. When I say Tuesday morning, that's this morning. That's right now. Outside its Central Cathedral of Learning, which they said in the news release was done in solidarity with students at a list of other schools. Some 300 students staged a solidarity walkout at Stanford University on Monday, yesterday, to show support for Palestinians in Gaza and their pro-Palestinian peers at other colleges, according to the Stanford Daily. Students have also put up encampments at several Boston-area schools, including the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, Emerson College, Tufts University. Harvard University has also closed Harvard Yard to the public through Friday in apparent anticipation of potential protests. And at the University of Michigan, student groups erected some 24 tents in the middle of campus on Monday. Michigan Public, whatever that is, reports that some 100 people gathered for a rally that afternoon, chanting, "Disclose, divest, we will not stop, we will not rest." Is that anti-Semitic? Is that chant? Is there something wrong with that chant? I don't see it. Disclose, divest, we will not stop, we will not rest. Students at the University of California, Berkeley, the Stony Brook of the West, they also set up a Gaza solidarity encampment yesterday, on Monday. Organizers told the local ABC channel that they want school leaders to end what they're calling their silence over the situation in Gaza and to provide better protection for Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim students. Recent turmoil has raised even more questions about the responsibility of universities when it comes to balancing students' safety with freedom of expression. Some pro-Palestinian activists have publicly said that they are protesting Israel, not Jews. Yeah, I mean, that is the assumption. They noted their ranks include many Jewish students. How do you accuse Jewish students of being anti-Semitic? How exactly do you pull that off? Well, you do it by not telling the world that, boy, a lot of people that are protesting Israel happen to be Jews. You don't say that part. At Columbia and Yale, some even came together for Passover Seders in the middle of the protest. Can't get much more Jewish than that. Debbie Becker, a sociology professor at Barnard College, which is part of Columbia, told Morning Edition on NPR today that the campus feels relatively safe and peaceful, unlike the portrayals of it on social media. What a surprise. Kind of similar to our trip across the country where, hey, guess what? It's not a war ground. You know, people actually can communicate. Maybe even get things done. Debbie Becker described the pro-Palestinian encampment as a place of sharing and community building. Students have watched movies there. They hold teach-ins. They study. They eat together. Hey, they're doing all the things the universities should be doing. They've taken control themselves. They're doing it on their own. Applause to them. You know, I remember here at Stony Brook, something similar. The protest, I think, was for graduate students getting a fair wage, because they certainly were not, probably still aren't. And we wound up camping out in tents right outside the library. And it was it was as much punishment as I needed. It was not comfortable at all, trying to sleep on the academic mall. No. But it was to prove a point. I don't know why I was doing it. I wasn't a graduate student, but, you know, I was in support. And that was enough. And, you know, we didn't get our heads busted. We didn't get arrested. I think we got ignored mostly. But it did get attention. And it is a legitimate way to express yourself. And that is what people are doing. Maybe even at Stony Brook right now. I can tell you exactly where to go, too. It's that part right in front of the library, you know, the part they built backwards where you see the other end of the bridge. Not so much close to the administration building, more towards the astronomy building, you know, ESS building. You can get about maybe 20 tents there. Then you have to start spreading out a little bit, and yeah, any place that's grass is good. So, yeah, put up signs, have a megaphone. This is what people remember for the rest of their lives. Now, is there negativity? Of course. Anytime you have a group of people, there's going to be negativity of one sort or another. The Anti-Defamation League has tracked several instances of protesters expressing support for Hamas and the October 7th attack. We refer to such people as idiots. They should either be ignored or expelled. From the group, from the college, I don't care. That's not what any of this is about. A protester at Columbia held up a sign reading Al-Khazam's next targets with an arrow pointing towards a nearby pro-Israel counter-protest, a bunch of counter-protesters. And that, of course, refers to Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas. Again, idiot. Somebody who really does not deserve to be there in a place of learning, because they're clearly going in the other direction. But do you define an entire group of people based on the actions of one idiot who's not even affiliated with them? And if this person is affiliated with them, show that. You know, let's see an actual group that says something insanely stupid like that. All it takes is one person to get an entire group labeled as anti-Semites and terrorists. So you have to ask yourself, where did that one person come from? Is that one person truly an idiot, or is that one person perhaps somebody planted there to make everybody look the way they are desired to look by the mass media, by the mainstream? Now, ADL also says students at various schools have also waved signs glorifying figures associated with U.S. designated terror groups using pro-Intifada slogans. Okay, well, let me just stop you right there. Intifada is rebellion. All right, it started with a bunch of kids throwing stones at tanks back when Ariel Sharon did something horrible. It's a legitimate form of protest. It's the only form of protest when you don't have anything else. And it's an inspiration. Now, has it been marred a bit or degraded to mean something more, perhaps. But to me, Intifada simply symbolizes people with nothing but stones fighting back against occupation. I dare say we'd be doing the same thing. So a pro-Intifada slogan, that's not enough. That is not enough right there. I'm sorry. What else? Calls for destroying Zionism. And either hounding, or getting rid of Zionists altogether. Well, okay, that's an interesting point. That is an interesting point because, you know, back in 1975, there was this United Nations General Assembly resolution, you might have heard of it, called 3379, adopted November 10th, 1975. It determines that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. 72 votes in favor, 35 votes against. 32 abstentions. Yeah, that actually happened. It was in the context of the Declaration on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, adopted on November 10, 1963. And Resolution 3379 officially condemned the national ideology of the State of Israel. It was sponsored by the Arab League and a number of Muslim-majority countries, and was chiefly supported by in-favor votes from the Second World and many African countries. Israel, which had been granted United Nations membership in 1949, voted against it, obviously, subsequently condemned it, and was chiefly supported by the First World. But the fact remains, this happened. The United Nations. So, okay, you can say people calling for the elimination of Zionism are horrible people. But then you say the United Nations is comprised of horrible people. Well, probably, yeah. Well, let's not act shocked that things like this happen. Instead, let's study what it is we're actually talking about. They're talking about racial discrimination. All right, and how Palestinians are basically subjugated and taken advantage of in so many ways. You cannot deny that. That is happening. They are not thought of as human because, you know, if you thought of somebody as human, you would not be blowing up their neighborhoods. We raised this this point weeks ago. If Hamas were hiding out in Tel Aviv somewhere, you know, somehow they got in, somehow they were hiding out, you knew they were around, would you blow up Tel Aviv? Well, the Israeli government would have to, wouldn't they? Netanyahu says this is the kind of thing that happens in war, and innocent people die. Oh, not your innocent people, just those ones. Yeah, tell me about your fairness there. Doesn't exist. So when people say things that might be a bit short-sighted, like Zionism must go, and Zionism, by the way, is basically the right of the Jewish people to have their own state. Something I think the vast majority of us support. But that meaning has been tarnished by the actions of the Israeli government and the Israeli military. They are hurting the cause of Zionism more than anybody right now. So maybe, you know, you take that into account when you see people saying things like Zionism must go. What they're referring to is what they're seeing on the news. Seeing entire families wiped out, seeing apartment buildings destroyed, places that are obviously not military targets. Oh, but there's always a reason why it's okay in this particular case. Because Hamas was somewhere in the building, and they were using human shields. Well, the whole point of human shields is you don't blow up the human shields. You know, that's part of civilization. I mean, imagine if every bank robber holding a hostage in front of him wound up having the hostage killed. I guess maybe, theoretically, there'd be less bank robberies with people doing that. But we would be somewhat less if we didn't think of people in an impossible situation. If we thought of them as expendable, completely expendable, I think we'd be so much less as far as what we stand for, what we believe in. Continuing here with this NPR coverage, tensions reached such a boiling point at Columbia that a university-affiliated rabbi urged Jewish students over the weekend to return home for their own safety. Wow, okay, that's something. So, tensions reached such a boiling point because people were using pro-intifada slogans, waving some signs that said stupid things, and saying nasty things about Zionism, no doubt without understanding what Zionism is really all about. And that led to a rabbi saying, everybody has to go home now for your own safety. Nothing here shows me where people are actually in danger. Yeah, it's a spirited debate, it's a conversation. All kinds of things are being said in the passion of the moment. But it all pales in comparison to what's going on in the place in question. Isn't that where we should be looking? How do we look there and say, you know what, that's okay? New York City Mayor Eric Adams spoke out against anti-Semitic incidents and hate speech at Columbia. In a statement that referenced specific incidents, including a woman yelling, we are Hamas, and student groups chanting, we don't want no Zionists here. Again, one idiot saying we are Hamas does not define a movement. People saying we don't want no Zionists here are clearly not saying we don't want no Jews here. They don't want pro-Israeli government people who stand up and support murder. And yes, dare I say it, genocide. That's what they don't want. And that's got nothing to do with a race, a religion, a people. That's got to do with a regime. A regime that, quite frankly, has to go. And the Israeli people know this more than anybody. Same thing with Iran. You know, over the last week, 10 days or so, we've seen kind of a bizarre back and forth between those two countries, who are really, you know, you can insult everybody by saying, boy, you guys are so similar. But in many ways, the way they are dealing with the situation is very similar. Israel killed a top Iranian military leader, I believe it was, in Syria. Everybody knew Iran was going to respond. It was like, you know, being in junior high school, where you pissed off the big guy, and everybody knew he was going to kick your ass after school. Everybody's talking about it. Oh, he's coming for you. Everybody knew Iran was going to respond. I don't know how word got out. And sure enough, almost on schedule, Iran fired they launched these drones that were going to arrive in Israel in about 3 hours. I mean, it was the most slow motion attack I think I've ever witnessed. You know, it's like saying, okay, Southwest Airlines is going to arrive at this particular time, except maybe a little bit more accurate. And, okay, so we've got these drones on the way to us. What are we going to do? And you know what they did? They shot down the drones when they finally arrived. And yeah, there were some missiles as well, but they didn't really do anything. So Israel was in an interesting position where they had to say, yeah, you didn't hurt us, but we're going to get you for trying to hurt us. And the United States was kind of like, guys, why don't you just both back off a little bit and let's move on. No, Israel could not let that happen, so they fired back. And Iran said the same thing. Yeah, you didn't hurt us. But they said something different. They said, we're not going to do anything. It's a lot like junior high school. It really is. Anyway, gist of the matter is, people are speaking out. That's always a good thing. Will they get things wrong? Absolutely. But as long as they keep listening, and that is important, that we have the dialogue, as long as we have certain common points, such as not supporting mass casualties of civilians in any context, and having peace be the ultimate goal. You know, as long as we can agree on that, then there's hope. But if we can't agree on that, then what are we doing? You know, we're saying that this is just going to go on forever and ever. You know, you're not going to get rid of Hamas this way. Anybody can tell you that. And clearly Netanyahu is just trying to save his own ass. Remember, there were all these protests against him before all of this started. They're not happening anymore because the country's at war. He knows what he is doing. And in the end, when everything comes out in the wash, I think that's going to be made quite clear. He took advantage of the situation, maybe even allowed security to be overrun to allow October 7th to happen in the first place. That's a stretch, I know, but nothing's beyond people like him. Anyway, in closing, keep thinking, keep speaking out. Don't let people intimidate you, whether it's university authorities, whether it's invading armies, whether it's overall nasty people. Anyway, I want to go out with a song that I've been thinking of a lot lately. It's one of those old classics. It came out in the autumn, but makes me think of spring. It needs no introduction. We all know it. And it's got that famous false start and that weird part at the end. I think it'll just make us all feel better. OTW at 2600.com. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Right. One, two, three, four.